Full Story is supported by AMP Super. There are moments in life where everything shifts. A new job, a new home, a new direction. But those same moments can also shape your future. AMP calls these super moments. Times to check in on your super. And with 24/7 digital financial advice, AMP Super helps you make more confident decisions as your situation changes. Search AMP Super Moments to find out more. AMP Super. Built for life's super moments. AMP Super, issued by NM Superannuation Proprietary Limited. See PDS and TMD on amp.com.au and consider what's right for you.
This is The Guardian. I'm Jo Tovey, and this is the Full Story Newsroom Edition. As the rise of One Nation continues to drive a realignment on the right of Australian politics, this week we saw signs of a possible shift in the progressive centre. A handful of independent parliamentarians have spoken up about the possibility for a new teal-tinged party. It came as the government pushed ahead with budget reform in the wake of worsening poll numbers for the PM, and Tony Abbott is set to be crowned as the next president of the Liberal Party. It's been a reasonably exciting week so far in politics, hasn't it, Mike Tisher?
It has. Not just Tony Abbott has been back in the news, but also Malcolm Turnbull and Paul Keating and even Julia Gillard in some corners of the media. So it's just like Groundhog Day in politics. But if that excites you, yes.
Joining us to discuss all this from Canberra is Chief Political Correspondent Dan Jervis-Bardi. Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
All right, so let's start with this mooted new party being considered by some independents. David Pocock really kicked this off this week. On Sunday, though, the wind has come out of it somewhat already, hasn't it, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, Pocock didn't exactly give it a ringing endorsement when he was asked about it on Insiders. He admitted that he'd been involved in talks, but he wasn't leading talks about a possible new party. Zali Steggall and Allegra Spender seem to be more enthusiastic, but others of the Teals seem to be much less enthusiastic. Kate Chaney and Monique Ryan particularly, others kind of on the fence. No one certainly is coming out and saying, yes, this is the time, this is what it's called, sign me up here. But it is a really interesting new wrinkle, I think, a new development in the what we've been talking about a lot this year, which is the whole realignment of politics. And although it was talked about in some ways as a kind of something that needed to be done because of the rise of One Nation, I think it's much more a product of the rise of One Nation and the knock-on effect of the Liberal Party and the Coalition generally having been driven further to the right, opening up wider the space in the centre or the centre-right, if you like, for a smaller Liberal Party to which the Teals and perhaps other independents might be drawn and perhaps even other disaffected moderate Liberals, but we're a long way from that, I think.
I'll come back to the Liberals in a second, but Dan, just for the independents that have at least expressed an openness to this, what is behind that? What's in it for them in forming a political party?
So I think it became clear that there were sort of two primary motivations. One was the passage of electoral donations reform that happened early last year. And just to sort of quickly summarise, the intention of that ostensibly was to get big money, sort of Clive Palmer-style money, out of politics. But what the changes did, and they were legislated under a deal between the two major parties, was they probably disadvantaged independents and made it more attractive to form a party structure and particularly a big party structure. So the second motivation kind of goes to this thing that I think regardless of where you are on the political spectrum is a constant motivator, and that's power and relevance and how to get both of them. Is the Teals have been around for at least a term. In the case of Zali Steggall, she's now in her third term. And they have been a new part of the political discussion. They push important causes. I think they're an important voice, but they don't have any power in the way that the parliament is formed at the moment. And I think that there has been an increasing realization among some of those independents and also the communities they represent of we like this brand of politics, we think there is space for this brand of politics, but how do we actually get results? How do we influence the political debate? Because the reality is at the moment, they don't have direct influence. It's a moot discussion. It's a debate as to whether or not forming a party would potentially allow them to do that. And we can probably get into some of that. But those are kind of the two motivations, the realities of how do we deal with these donation laws, and then the bigger question of how can we remain relevant.
And tied to that issue of power is this Senate, right? Like we've seen a lot of independents get elected in the lower house. It is easier to run a campaign in a small local electorate. Outside the smaller states or territories, it's very hard to get elected as an independent to the Senate. And, you know, we contrast where the Teals are at compared to the Greens, who have a big presence in the Senate.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are getting to essentially sort of green or red light government legislation at the moment, right?
Correct, yeah.
Obviously, I take the point that Dan's made that you want your MP to be forming policy in the sense that they're part of a party that is in government or has the balance of power in the parliament. But the reason they were elected in the first place is because people liked their independence and the fact that they were able to speak on issues that they cared about and that their voters cared about, obviously, because they voted them in. So you can understand why people want to be in a government in actually implementing policy in a much more rigorous and broad-ranging fashion, but maybe that's a lot of expectation on an individual MP.
Yeah, and I guess that sort of takes us into some of the pitfalls here. We've talked about some of the reasons why they might want to do this, but it's pretty fraught with risk in it. People who've built their whole brand on, I'm an independent, I'm not beholden to a party line, but maybe I'll join and form a political party. What do you see as the risks here, Dan?
I think the biggest risk is what is the single quality that is most attractive at the moment in Australian politics? It's not being part of the political establishment. So much of the rise of One Nation can be attributed to that. And I think it's the reason why the independents got elected in 2022 and then held their seats in 2025 is because they're not like the others. And I think there is a huge risk that if they were to establish a party, even if it was very different, I think Zali Steggall has been quite clear that even if there was some sort of party structure, it wouldn't be similar to Labor or the coalition in the way that it binds members to certain positions or discourages them from speaking out. But still that very idea of being part of a party and trying to influence politics through that structure is a risk because of what the community is screaming out for is the very opposite of that. So I think that's clearly the biggest risk for them. And I think, like you said, Joe, they've built their brand on being able to go around, seek the views of their communities and elevate that in Canberra. And to what extent would that be diluted if they had to consult with, in the case of, say, Monique Ryan, having to consult with a position that Allegra Spender had in Bondi, and how much of that would relate to her constituents?
Yeah, because as soon as you have a caucus of any kind, however loosely constituted, you're going to have disagreements within it. And then the media, rightly, will be saying, well, this person has a very different position on this issue than you do, so there's like a split in this party on this.
And there is nothing that we like more than a story about an MP breaking ranks.
Exactly.
There is six people breaking ranks.
It's interesting what you said, though, about Zali Steggall said this, and David Pocock also made this point on The Guardian's podcast this week, that a party wouldn't necessarily have to have that binding structure that we're so used to in Australia and that the media is sort of addicted to reporting on those splits. He didn't name overseas examples, but he sort of said it happens overseas, and I wondered if he was sort of alluding to the Democrats in the US, where it's the home of both Zoran Mamdani and Bernie Sanders. It's also Bill Clinton and Gavin Newsom. Like, there is a lot of variation within the Democrats. Could a party like that work here where there was a freer structure, or is that a bit of a pipe dream, do you guys think?
Like, the Democrats don't have a leader except when there's a presidential election or the president is a Democrat. They don't really have a party leader as such in the same way we would here, whereas an Australian party you'd think would have to have a leader and they would set the tone very distinctively for what that party was about. And if other people in that party disagreed with the leader, then that would become a big issue, I think.
Yeah.
I think it is much harder to disagree substantively on a lot. Not that the Teals necessarily would, but there are certainly some issues where I'm sure they would go their different ways. And And that would become very difficult to manage, I think, in our party structure. I don't know what Dan thinks about that.
Yeah, I mean, and also that in a lot of ways the Teals are different, but they're also politicians and they've got egos.
Yeah. Mm.
There was lots of rumours around this building about discussions that were held towards the back end of last year among some of the independents, and there was disagreement of who would be the party leader. Now, I don't know how much veracity there is to that, but there is certainly through the conversations that I've had, it's become clear that, you know, these are politicians that are ambitious, and the idea that one of them would cede authority to another is not necessarily, you know, something that they would do. I think just going back to what David Pocock said about the model that this could work through is, I mean, when we saw headlines of kind of Teal Party, we rushed to sort of assume it would be the kind of traditional party structure. I mean, one of the options could just be a model in which resources are pooled and they work more closely together on developing policy. You know, they all have individual media advisors, for instance. Could they have just one or two to work across them? Things like that that are a bit more practical to help share resources, share the load, perhaps have some MPs taking the lead on certain issues, others taking the lead on others. So there are lots of different options that could kind of fit under the umbrella of working together that isn't forming a official political party.
Another factor that's been raised by some of these independents in favour of the party is that it would help counterbalance the rise of One Nation. I've seen some commentary around this week that it would actually be a gift to One Nation because it would sort of diminish the appeal of the Teals. And I think Janet Albrickson was writing that it would sort of reveal them to have been the sort of secret party that a lot of people have always accused them of working within. What do you guys think about whether this would be a sort of effective way to counterbalance One Nation or not?
Yeah, I think it's a question that I've sort of tried to get my head around is how exactly does this potentially help fend off One Nation? I suppose if we think about where this party or where this alliance would sit on the political spectrum, you know, potentially they're doing the job of the Liberal moderates in kind of speaking for kind of socially progressive, economically conservative people and pushing back against the populist message that One Nation is advocating. I mean, potentially if you had a united party structure, they would get more prominence. I'm just thinking practically in terms of my job in Parliament House, if, you know, the Teal Party called a press conference, would it be more likely that we would go because it would be a coherent position as opposed to kind of three or four of them we've seen on the CGT, for instance, is a sort of steady trickle of the MPs coming out with positions. Would it be different if they just announced it all together and it's a stronger position and in a way that gets more coverage and then that helps drown out or at least push back against some of the other commentary around One Nation potentially? But I think we're kind of scratching around for rationale on that space. I just don't think that it's a huge motivator, and maybe it's more of a kind of a marketing exercise, a selling point for this group to say they're pushing back against One Nation because there is kind of electoral benefit in being seen as the force resisting this rising tide.
And there is one way in which it could help One Nation in that if it took votes off Labor or even seats off Labor in the sort of middle ring suburbs where Labor were very successful at the last election, if it diminishes Labor's number of seats in Parliament and One Nation also do well in their particularly strong areas, then that kind of gets more towards, you know, a minority government or potentially even a One Nation government if things continue to go in the direction they're currently going.
Finally, I just want to touch on the Liberal Party of all of this. There was sort of talk earlier this week that this mooted party could be not just a place for Teals, but also for disaffected moderate Liberals who are feeling despairing about the rightward lurch of the party. Your reporting this week, though, Dan, suggested that that might not be the case. What did you find?
I think what became clear in having conversations with people in the quote-unquote Teal movement, but also in the Liberal space, was that there are, broadly speaking, lots of conversations going on. Everybody is talking about what is the future of politics, where do we go from here given the shifting landscape. And I think in some of the reporting, perhaps those conversations were conflated into working towards one single outcome. So this sort of alliance of moderate Liberals with Teals. I think the reality is there isn't a group of moderate Liberals in Canberra at the moment who are sitting down with Zali Steggall preparing to move across. We reported earlier this week that there was discussions between a group of ex-Liberal staffers, predominantly from the sort of Turnbull-Morrison years who have left the party, that are kind of active in thinking about what next. But in terms of Liberals being prepared to move over and actually join the Teals, I think we're a very, very long way away from that. But I guess the kind of bigger picture is everybody's talking about this because, and we've spoken about it a lot, is this is existential for the Liberal Party, and their members, their MPs know it. They just kind of don't know what's next, what the future holds.
Mm-hmm. Turnbull's name has been thrown around quite a lot as being potentially involved himself. What do you reckon about that?
Yeah, I mean, he was obviously interviewed on RN. I don't think it wouldn't have been very difficult to get him to hop on the radio and talk about it. I mean, he made it clear that he'd spoken. He clearly speaks to a lot of people. I doubt that he's had an active role in recruiting either Liberals or Teals, but he's clearly somebody who sits in that space on the political spectrum that has now been vacated by the Liberal Party. So, I mean, I think he probably knows that he can't be the face of this thing for obvious reasons, but I think he's an interesting character in that he symbolises something that the Liberals no longer are. And I think for voters in certain parts of the country, it's useful to see him come forward and you see what has been lost.
Mm.
I know this podcast comes out on Friday, and on Friday afternoon, Tony Abbott's expected to be formally named the next president of the Federal Liberal Party. Thus begins an era that Alex Antich has described as one being led by a dream team of Abbott as the federal president, Angus Taylor as Liberal leader, and Matt Canavan as National Party leader. I'm just interested in your thoughts, Dan, what you think that's going to mean for the Liberal Party and where it's going.
Whew, deep breath. We've known for a very long time that Tony Abbott is a hugely influential person behind the scenes. He's influential over Angus Taylor and the conservative wing of the party. He'll now have a more active role. Now, the president's role is largely ceremonial. It's unpaid. You're supposed to have no influence, but you speak to anyone in this building and they say that Tony Abbott is not going to be a traditional Liberal Party president. The interesting thing for me is Tony Abbott has been a kind of thought leader for the Liberal Party for a very long time. He's been further to the right than even Angus Taylor on issues like immigration and net zero. To what extent does his views become the party's views and they go further to the right? But also, again, a kind of a bigger picture is Tony Abbott, if you read his essays or listen to him on podcast, he's not really necessarily engaged in the sort of domestic political fight over what Albanese did on this or that. His big fight is this broader struggle for Western civilization and whether multiculturalism and globalization can fit within that. So if that becomes one of the motivations of the parliamentary party, that we are now kind of preoccupied with this big struggle for Western civilization, then I think that's going to be very problematic for the Liberal Party. And it might sound a bit hyperbolic, but for a lot of them in this building, and certainly for Abbott, that is the main game. The culture wars are not side issues. They are central issues. And I think that's going to make it fascinating to see.
Mm. And he doesn't necessarily know that putting his face at the head of that is not the right thing to do for promoting those issues, in the way you said that Turnbull probably does see that. Mm. Not that Turnbull is necessarily personal insight, but I think Dan's right that he recognises that he can't be the face of any new movement.
But not encumbered by those feelings.
No. It doesn't have that reluctance to put himself forward, no.
And it's not a secret that he wants to be back in Parliament. Mm. It's not a kind of media beat-up or unsubstantiated rumours. He loves this stuff and he believes it's part of his mission to serve and to fight for the country. And this is the role at this moment that he's going to do it through. And I think he wants to ultimately get back into Parliament.
Mm. But I mean, just thinking about the Teals or that sort of space of politics more generally, it was Abbott who was the first person who really the independents who were elected in those seats were rebelling against and reacting against, and putting him back a face from the past and someone so closely identified with, as Dan said, that cultural warrior position, I just can't feel that's anything but a really negative for the Liberal Party. Some people love him. It's sort of a little bit analogous to Donald Trump in the US at the moment, or not that I'm saying Tony Abbott is anything like a Donald Trump figure personally, whereas he's insanely popular inside his own party or sections of his own party, but that doesn't really reflect more broadly in the wider electorate. Mm. In fact, he's extremely unpopular with quite large sections of the wider electorate.
I want to just turn to the government briefly at the end here. They've had a pretty rough week. Bad poll numbers for Albanese personally and a furious campaign against the budget tax overhaul. But are they actually in trouble at the moment, or is this just the kind of normal bumps that comes with big reform? What do you think, Mike?
They're going to be tested. Like, there's a campaign going on. Obviously, there's been a sort of, I think, quite, they may have been taken by surprise a bit by the level of the social media and the areas where the social media campaign has taken the reaction to the budget. So to some extent, it's where their mettle is. They knew these were going to be controversial changes to get through. They must have expected there would be a strong reaction to it. Are they prepared to tough it out? I think it's going to be a really interesting question as to what extent, once they start making carve-outs on that issue particularly, everyone is going to be jumping up and down saying, what about me? So
we've seen them back down a bit before, like the super debate, which was probably less vocal than this, taxing the $3 million plus super accounts. There was a bit of a back down there, maybe unnecessarily.
But they've kind of gone with the boldness. Mm. If you go with the boldness, you have to kind of stick with it, I think, to be credible on that. And so if they make big concessions to vested interest groups, then I think that is not going to reflect well among what should be their core constituency they're trying to attract.
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the real narratives of the Albanese government has been their reluctance to engage in these fights. I mean, that was the story really of the first 4 years. Now with this budget, they've openly created the fights that they've resisted up until now. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see the way that they respond to that through the process of dealing with potential carve-outs, but also what it potentially means in the sort of slightly longer term about the way that they pursue ambitious reform. You know, the language that Albanese was using prior to the budget, it really seemed like a tipping point moment for the approach that his government was taking, that, you know, the status quo doesn't work. We have to change. Now, is he going to be frightened because of the way that this has been reacted to? And is that going to potentially put him off having to do changes in the future? Because the pressure to do things now is kind of, he's shown that he's prepared to do it or at least propose it, but we're going to see it on the gas tax. That issue isn't going away. We're going to see it on the diesel fuel rebate. That issue isn't going to go away. There's going to be continual demands for more changes to the tax system. And I'm just fascinated to see to what extent any scars from this debate influences the way that he pursues those issues down the track.
They must have factored that in, right? When they decided to make a bolder decision in this budget, they must have thought about what the reaction would be, don't you think?
It seems so that they were factoring in the housing fight, but it was maybe perhaps these other skirmishes on shares, on small business, that does seem to have taken them by surprise, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you were to speak to Jim Chalmers on budget night and say, what are the two things that you want voters to take out of this budget, he would have said, we want young people to feel like they're going to be able to get in the housing market, and we want people to feel like we're starting that process of rebalancing the tax system to reduce the burden on workers and to increase it on other types of income. There really hasn't been a lot of discussion about either of those things. It's been completely consumed by issues that I don't think the government properly wargamed or expected. And I think part of that goes to, you know, they're very savvy, experienced people, but there aren't a lot of business owners in cabinet. There aren't a lot of business owners in treasury. You know, they've got a bit of a shock in certain areas about the issues that perhaps hadn't been foreseen, and now they're having to explain them and potentially remedy them.